Accession number 9902, Reel 1.
Mrs. Pearson, first of all, could I ask you something about your background? You know, where you were born and brought up.
Yes. Do I speak into this?
Just speak normally, yes.
Well, I was born in Bombay in 1902. Is that necessary or not? I don't know. And mother and father had been there for some years, and my father was a publisher, and my mother had been born in Bombay, but her father and mother had lived in India for many years, my grandmother being educated in Madras, where my grandfather found her in the English school where she was being taught, and had lost her father and mother because they died of dysentery. They were, all my relations were in the Indian army of occupation, and therefore I suppose I'm the granddaughter of the Raj. But I didn't know that part of India very well, except in Bombay, where my grandfather had horses and carriages and so on, as he was commissioner of the Bombay police, having been seconded from the army. My father was interested in world politics and used to write to the magazines in England, and was quite well known as a journalist amongst men who were publishing papers in India. Father did some work for the Times of India, and he was correspondent for the Manchester Guardian. And he was invited by Robert Young, who had an English newspaper in Japan, in Kobe, to become the managing editor of the Japan Chronicle. And he went there at the end of the First World War. And he came back and forth from India or Japan every few years, so my mother was rather cut off from him after we had been taken to England when I was five. And I was really six, and my brother was five, and my sister was three.
Yes, I must ask you about your education. This is the important thing, your own experience. I wonder how this fitted into your father's rather international life.
Well, father took me on his knee. When I first came to England, I was only one, and I had to be introduced to the family in England, whom my mother was meeting for the first time. And mother was entirely disorientated when she came to England, because England was not her background. She knew the rivers of India, and she didn't know the rivers of England. So when she came to Southampton with us as three small children, she had to fit into English life, which she found quite difficult. But she herself went back with my younger sister, and my brother and I were left in England to be brought up by a foster mother whom my mother knew when she used to live in Bombay. And the family of foster children were 11 in number. There were three of Auntie Redmayne's own family. She'd lost her husband in India. And there were three children of the Imrie family, Scottish people, whom she'd met in India. And there were three of us, eventually. So that was nine. And there were two children who were of the Booker family, all came from India. So she had this large house in Devonport outside Stockport in Cheshire, and she brought us up very quietly and justly and intelligently, because she was a loving person and had two or three servants to help her, Madge and nursemaids to take us for walks and so on, and she herself taught us to read and write. And so,
yes. Would this have been normal for children of, you know, families serving in India?
Well, I always read Kipling's life story, and he was born just about 10 years before I was, and he came home to England and was put with some aunt or uncle whom he dreaded. He found it was ghastly, I think in Brighton or somewhere in Sussex. But my aunt, Aunt of Redmayne, was a Lancashire woman with a very warm heart and a very enlightened outlook. And so it was very pleasant for us to be brought up together, different ages. We ranged from 18 to 5, you see. And so we were rather a handful for her to manage, because she had to be just. And yet the people in the middle of the group wanted more cake, but she decided that she wasn't going to be harassed by these children wanting larger pieces of cake, so she was going to weigh every single piece of cake that we all had equal shares. Because if you have ravenous children, and certainly boys, they can eat the whole thing without turning a hair. But she was going to be just, and she had a very fair idea that she was going to show that there was equality, and therefore she had these scales out, and she would weigh every piece of cake.
You were saying about your father and his Japanese experience. You know, obviously Japan is the main focus of interest in this interview.
Yes, well, I'll go on to that.
Yes, later on. But at this stage, you know, while you were a child, did you have any links with Japan? Did you ever go with your
father? No, my father went there without any knowledge of Japan at all, with an open heart. But he found the Japanese rather exclusive and not wanting to entertain you in their own homes. They rather thought that a foreigner should be entertained in a restaurant and never be brought to the Japanese house. And that, of course, remains to this day. Any Japanese now always thinks that their home is not grand enough, and therefore you must go out to a restaurant to be entertained. But that is breaking down. The English people, of course, always think you must have your homemade food and everything must be brought.
Would you have been in England during World War One? You know, you were growing
up. Yes, I was.
This time.
My father was in Japan during World War One, and quite a number of the office people, the three sons of the editor, came to England to join up. And I remember one of them, Arthur, or the eldest one, came in khaki to see us in Cheshire. And that was my contact with the First World War. And I was told he went with the first 100,000, wasn't it, to France and was killed. And so, in that way, I felt the tragedy of losing this beautiful young man. Even when I was 7 or 8, he disappeared, you see. He went to the war and was cut off in his prime. And that, of course, was the tragedy of the First World War, wasn't it? And I didn't know anything except, I think, a lack of food. The First World War, of course, we didn't have enough butter or eggs or anything that children should have when they're growing. And I think that when you, later on, certain deficiencies in your physique come to the fore, and you realize that you must have missed out on having particular sort of chemicals in your youth that you should have had when you were growing up. Your bones are not strong enough and that sort of thing. Well, that's the only part of the war that influenced me at all, except that I do remember I was part of it, because, you see, I was only 10 when it broke out. And, or was it, I don't know, really, I can't do the sum. My mother had to make do all the time, and she'd been waited on by servants in India and found it very hard to do any housework at all. But we did have Alice, the maid, who went off to make munitions. That was in the middle of the First World War. And so we had to do things ourselves. I was made to cook, and Mother said, you know much more about the stove than I do, so will you make a supper, please? And so at the age of 11 or 12, Mother would ask me how to make cheese toast, that kind of thing. I didn't know how to look after people when they were ill. My mother suddenly had to go to bed, and I thought I'd make some beef tea, which I put all the meat into a glass jar, and of course promptly it broke in the hot water that I put it in.
How about your education? Did you go to school?
I went to an elementary school. I learnt sewing. St. George's Elementary School in Stockport. But I was only there for a couple of years. Then I went to Stockport High School. I got a scholarship, and it was a very good one, because even my lunches and elocution lessons were paid for. So it was a very good scholarship. It was a county scholarship, but they I think they had about four or five. And I happened to get one of the better ones, and Mother was very proud of me, you see. I was supposed to be read something, be able to say it immediately afterwards, so it didn't matter. However, I did quite well at school, and it was a time when girls were looking for further education. The headmistress was enlightened, rather like the headmistress of Manchester High School, because they were in friends, and Monsieur, the headmistress, was very enlightened. And my friends all went to Manchester University, and my mother said, oh, you must go in for the Oxford entrance papers, and those were sent to me, and I could have come to Oxford, but I preferred to go with my friends to the university, to Manchester. And I was very glad, because all my friends went with me to Manchester University, and my great aunts, who were a great influence in my life, invited me to London. And that was when I was about 15, I think, or perhaps 16, when the exhibition was on. What was that? The Wembley exhibition was on. And they said, you must come to stay with us for 2 weeks and we'll show you the whole of London. And this really was a turning point in my early life, because my great-aunt Emma and my great-aunt Grace were both graduates of London University and had headmistresses in the East End of London. No man ever wanted to go to the East End of London as a headmaster, so the women had to take the post, and really they were very strong-minded women. They knew exactly what they wanted. So my Aunt Emma and my Aunt Grace showed me the whole of London, including a visit to the theatre to see Chu Chin Chow. And my Aunt Emma said, we are doing this for you because your father isn't here. He was our favourite nephew. And you must do this for anybody that you meet later on in life. You must show them something that they'll never forget. Well, I never forgot that. I knew nothing about what they were talking about. They said to me, we are handing everything to you on a plate. We've been suffragettes. We've been chained at the railings. We've been to prison. And now you have everything won for you. They thought getting the vote was the end of life, you see. It was very pathetic. But I suppose it's true in some ways. Getting the vote made it possible for us now to have a prime minister. All the men were the inspectors were men, and a young pipsqueak, as she called him, came to her school, and he said, oh, I don't like the smell in your cloakrooms. Oh yes, my aunt said, the damp clothes, that people have to hang up there, and they do smell rather horrid. And the cloakrooms, the lavatories are not very special. And so, and my aunt said, well, this really is too much. And I've endured this for the last 20 years. So the young man said, it's very difficult for an old dog to learn new tricks. And one of my aunts said, yes, especially from a puppy. And, of course, that was their feeling, that he came in, criticised everything that was obvious to anybody but couldn't be helped, because he was so superior, he had a higher standard of cleanliness and how things should be done. Well.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, you know, to hear about this background, but I really now would like to take you to China. But before we go, perhaps you could outline quite briefly what jobs you had, because I think you went into teaching, didn't you, after your
university? I went to France. I thought I was going to get a doctorate in English literature, and I was going to do it on the connection between Wordsworth, the Lake Poets, and the French revolutionaries, Lamartine and all the rest of the poets, and their interaction. And I found that I went to the Bibliothèque Nationale, and I was living with a French family, so my French was getting along quite well. But I liked clothes very much, and I wanted to buy some French clothes, and I hadn't enough money. So I went to a French school, and I asked them if they would take me on, as I had a degree in English, and I would teach French there. And they asked me if I had any training, so I said no. And have you had any experience? I said, no. And the young man who was the head of the English department said, they'll make mincemeat of you. And it so shocked me that I wrote to my aunt who lived in Cambridge to get me into a training college immediately, because I could never get a job unless I had some training or experience. And she did get me into the Cambridge Training College. And therefore, I was able to go the next term, because she had a house in Cambridge, so I lived with her for a bit in Cambridge Training College, where I got my year's training in teaching. And that, without that, I couldn't have got any post at all, because I went from there to Christ Hospital and was told that I had to stay for 3 years, and the headmistress wanted me to stay forever, because we were very much in tune with each other about modern methods of direct training in French, the speaking of French, and not only the academic part of it. And so that she liked me very much and wanted me to stay forever. So I said, well, I'll stay for 3 years. And I did that. My father came just in the nick of time and said I had to go to Japan. I had to go to the Far East. So I got a job in Shanghai, and that is where my Chinese experience began. On the ship going out, I met a lot of people going to Singapore and going to the rubber plantations, and people who were going to Hong Kong. But when I got to Shanghai, I couldn't understand. I couldn't tell one Chinese from the next, and they all seemed to be black-haired and black-eyed and very dirty and very black and very horrid. And I didn't like the smells. And as I went up the Huangpu, the tributary of the Yangtze, as we went into port, I was standing by the Consul General of Shanghai, who was then a man called Brennan. He became Sir John Brennan a little later, and he lived in the consulate. And he pointed to Shanghai as we came up the Huangpu, and he says, there is my prison. And I couldn't understand what he meant, but he really felt he was incarcerated in a foreign country which he hated, but he had to be the diplomat in charge of the affairs in the consulate. But he had a wife who was very nice, very charming, but good older than himself. And I think he really was quite an unhappy sort of man. And I, of course, didn't see him for about 5 years after I'd married my husband, who was also a semi-diplomat. He wasn't actually accredited to the consular service, but he was a British representative of the Chinese government. I think that the whole of my time teaching there was a stabilizing influence for me, but didn't bring me in contact at all with any Chinese. So I didn't learn any Chinese at all while I was on my work. The only thing I apparently was interested in was the clothes.
Yeah, who were your students then in Shanghai?
International group, chiefly British. It was a school founded by the British merchants of Shanghai, who all had what they called hongs and godowns for trading with the Chinese, either in textiles or machinery or building materials. Anything that the Chinese wanted, they could get from England and have factories or godowns in Shanghai where they supplied goods for anybody in the shops who wanted them. The Japanese were terribly jealous of the foreigners who came with goods from the other side of the world, and they wanted to oust British China, British building materials, British textiles, anything that the foreigners brought into Shanghai was anathema to the Japanese, who wanted the whole of the trade of their brothers and sisters in China. They felt so much more akin to the Chinese because they could read their scripts, they could read their literature. They were really the protégés of China, because Japan had copied everything from China, both the characters and architecture and some of the customs, but they weren't the same sort of people. The Japanese are water people. The Chinese are continental. They are river people too. But they're not at all the same stock. They seem to be more Mongolian, more land people, invaders from the north. And the Japanese seem to come from the Philippines, and that kind of atmosphere, more going about in boats all the time. Though, of course, the Chinese do too. I mean, they are, both of them, very much akin, but in different kinds of backgrounds.
This life, you know, when you went to Shanghai with your
yes.
British students, would you have been in a British area which was controlled by British?
I went to an American area. Where all the houses were built in the open style at that time of American architecture, which were centrally heated. It was the first time I'd been in a home. I lived with cousins who'd gone there years before, and lived in a centrally heated house with a bathroom to every bedroom, and that, of course, was quite jolly for me. I thought I would miss all the spring flowers in England. I arrived in February, and I went to the Chinese flower shops, and there were narcissi, every sort of flower that you would find in England in the spring were being cultivated by the Chinese, who are wonderful horticulturalists, and if the foreigners wanted spring flowers, they had them, because they knew how to produce them.
This area, though, would it have been cut off from the Chinese?
It was called the International Settlement. And every Frenchman went to his club, French club, and had his national day, the 14th of July. They had a big ball. And we had St. George's Day, and the Irish had St. Patrick's Day, and we all had commemorative traditions to keep up. And the Scottish ball on St. Andrew's Day, the 30th of November, was the big ball of the season in the international settlement. There are a tremendous number of engineers coming in by ship or who were Scots. And the Scots seem to be traditionally the leaders of expeditions to any country. I mean, I suppose you find more Scots in Canada or in New Zealand than any other, because their own country seems to be too small for them. And they are always going out in ships and being the first officer in the big liner. And most of the sailors seem to be Scots. I don't know. It's a very strong tradition of going abroad.
Did you mind the fact that you weren't interacting with Chinese?
No, not at all. I loved it because I cannot bear to be anything but English. And I think my husband, you see, having been there for some years, found I was rather refreshing, because he could talk to me about English history. Most of the people there knew nothing about English history. They'd been there since their childhood. They'd been brought up as Americans or Canadians or people like... He was particularly, my husband, before I arrived, was particularly irked, I think, at the American accent. And, you know, it does get on your nerves sometimes. And he thought, oh, well, here's somebody who speaks the same language as I do. He was Bristolian, and therefore had been brought up to say words in the same way as I did. And he liked me better than the Canadians and so on that he was mixing with at the time.
Were you interested in China at all?
Not at all.
As a country? Really?
My father, you see, was immensely interested. Being very much more cultivated than I was and knowing Japan, I was rather a disappointment to him because I didn't begin prattling Chinese immediately and getting to know Chinese. I did get to know quite a number of missionaries who were China orientated and who spoke Chinese, but they were only interested in me in that they wanted to know how many Christian converts I was going to make. And I said, well, I'm not connected with any missionary society. I'm here to teach English and French at this school. And I think they were rather... Everybody seemed to be disappointed in me in many ways, except the man I married, and he was very pleased. And therefore he could talk to me about anything he wanted.
I was going to ask you, now you've mentioned the missionaries, who the other English people would have been in Shanghai area at that time?
They were chiefly traders, bankers, people who wanted to, like Reuters, to put up a news agency of some sort or have articles written for different magazines and newspapers in England. There are a lot of journalists. I met a lot because I knew the editor of the North China Daily News, a man called O.M. Green. I didn't write anything for him, but when he changed to a man called Edwin Howard, I was put in charge of the literary page in the North China Daily News, which interested me enormously because I was really more English than the English, because I was interested still in what was being published in England and what people like Pearl Buck, who was publishing for the first time her books on China called The Good Earth, and that was making a tremendous impression on the international settlement, because they really didn't know anything about Chinese life. And so Pearl Buck opened up China for most people because they got to know what an ordinary Chinese woman would be feeling in the fields and the rice fields and going with her husband to probably produce a baby in the most primitive conditions, perhaps in a basket that her husband was carrying or anything. You got to know the real primitive Chinese from her books. And she opened up China for everybody, I think.
And was that important for you to have?
It was important for me because it was literature and her writing was so vivid. And my only introduction to China was from a book I had had got hold of called The House of Exile by Nora Warne. And I wrote to my father and I said, isn't The House of Exile a marvellous book? It tells you all about China. And father, in his cryptic way, said, yes, it gives you an account of everything but the smells. And I didn't realise it. Because, you see, you don't know the horrible smells in a primitive country, which have to be introduced to you to make you feel that you are part of the landscape. And you have, if you've got a very keen sense of smell, their flowers are so gorgeous, their jasmine and their tea and all that.